You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. This is our second episode of our Summer of Directors, and today we're going to delve into the work of Italian director Dario Argento. Master of horror? Master of crime stories? Or beyond that? We'll have to wait and see. Joining me today are Julie from Amsterdam. Welcome, Julie.
Hello.
And Alan from London. Hi, Alan.
Hello.
And as I know, you are both big fans and experts on horror cinema in particular. And of course, I'm very much looking forward to your takes on Argento's work. I'm really excited that we're able to do this in the context of our Summer of Directors. Dario Argento is probably one of the most famous Italian directors, specifically for horror films. But we want to put that into question today a little bit and to see how pure or impure his cinema is. He has many fans around the world for many of his movies. Suspiria, Tenebrae, Phenomena, those might be titles that our listeners might already be familiar with or more. His work has also been accused of being too violent, too misogynist, maybe rip-offs of other directors, or just incongruent and making little sense. And we want to attack all these accusations by looking at three of his key films. And we'll be starting with his very first one in a minute or two. But first, I wanted to know from you guys, thinking of Argento, what was your experience with him so far? When did you first become aware of him? And what is your general take on the wondrous world of Dario Argento? Julie, what about you?
I was not introduced to Argento as a horror director so much as a cult director. So you get this sort of, this is a cult film type deal, right? These sort of European directors, it's all very artsy, it's all very independent, it's all very off the mainstream. But as I got into his work more and more, because, you know, there's nothing like a really huge operatic, slashy horror gore fest, I started considering him a real horror director, I think more than a cult filmmaker. Although he has his very own, very specific voice. I will give you that.
How about you, Alan? How about you and Argento? What's the relationship?
Well, it started out probably quite a tricky relationship, because when I was sort of starting to get into watching films, when you read about Argento and I was getting really into horror films, I'd look at it and go, well, this doesn't look like it's for me. And he was often, oh, this is more intellectual, this is more surreal. And I would be sort of like, no, I'm quite into sort of the 80s horror. I want it scuzzy and I want it dark. This doesn't seem like anything is going to be much fun for me. And also it had the bit of he's the horror director that people who don't like horror name drop. So I think there was an element of snobbishness, and I was having the similar counter-snobbishness of, well, if they like him, then I'm going to stick to my cheap video nasties. So I think there was a long period where I was quite consciously not watching Argento. And then at some point, you crack, and then you just start watching it. And it is just really enjoyable, and a lot of what's said about him is right. But at the same time, I found the films compulsive viewing and just started watching all of them. And it just was that sort of thing, from being very reluctant at first and resisting to suddenly going, oh, actually, why have I been fighting this? This is
for too long. Well, I remember I came across Argento completely by coincidence on YouTube, you know, because some of his films were available for free viewing. And I watched The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, not knowing much about him. And I think I was just completely mesmerized by the gallery, and we'll talk about that later, the scene in the gallery. And from then on, I was just like taken in by his cinema and by the principles behind it and the things that also repeat over many of his films. And I started watching first his infamous Jolly, and then got into his more horror type movie or supernatural style stories. And just like you, Alan, I watched all of them, and now I've got his music and bought books about him. So really at this point, I'm really still opening up about Argento. I haven't seen all the films, but definitely want to now. And so I'm super excited also to talk about Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which is the first film that we're going to approach. Maybe just a few words. It is Argento's directorial debut. He had been writing screenplays before that for mostly B-movies, but then he was also the co-writer of a very famous spaghetti western, Once Upon a Time in the West by Sergio Leone, which he co-wrote with another famous director, Bernardo Bertolucci. And then his dad, a producer, wanted him to make one of his screenplays as a director himself because he thought it was a really good screenplay. And he gave his son the money and the opportunity to do Bird with Crystal Plumage in 1970. Now, it's considered a very famous giallo. So we'll maybe have to clarify a little bit. It means yellow in Italian and is based on these yellow books that you could buy anywhere in cheap bookstores and train stations. And it's basically those crime stories that have a certain number of elements in them, and Bird with Crystal Plumage is considered one of their best. Julie, you brought this one for us to the table, and you also kind of chose a particular focus. So tell us a little bit about Bird with the Crystal Plumage and what you find fascinating, interesting, controversial about it.
Well, Bird is probably, maybe not his best, but it's one of my favorites. In essence, as you say, it is comparable to a Penny Dreadful. It has a certain by-the-numbers discipline to it. So you have the amateur detective who solves the mystery of a serial killing, black-clad, knife-wielding murderer. So it's all, I mean, the source material is pretty tacky, really. But the way that this film is done and the way it plays with, for instance, camera setup, third-person omniscient camera that is not so omniscient, the first-person murderer perspective type camera that we are very familiar with from horror films like Halloween, that just gives it such added value, this film. So the most famous scene in this film is that our protagonist is an American writer who had planned to write the next great American novel, which of course he did not, witnesses a crime in a white gallery where a black-clad figure attacks seemingly a white-clad woman, and he gets locked in between two glass doors while she crawls towards him begging for help, the damsel in distress, and he can do nothing. He is completely powerless. He knocks on the windows hoping the police will come, but he's just shut in there and all he can do is watch. And that's what this movie is about. It's about seeing things and how you perceive them and what about your perception is true. And there's a part of memory in there as well. Now, the controversy I think about Bird is there is a scene where a lady, a very beautiful lady, significantly, puts on a negligee type thing, a teddy that is completely see-through. And then she gets attacked in her see-through little teddy by a knife-wielding maniac all in black. And it's a very rapey scene. It is very rapey. So, of course, the knee-jerk response to this from film critics and fans alike is misogyny. And I'm afraid I lose patience with that type of knee-jerk argument. We can get into it a little bit later what the sort of more academic argument is about this. But people, Perils of Pauline and The Woman in Distress and the gothic type Rebecca type deal is as old as the hills. We're not now going to pretend to be shocked that a pretty woman in a nightie is being attacked by a wild knife-wielding assassin. This is nothing new. I lose a little bit of patience with people who focus on this aspect of horror. Again, I won't spoil too much because it's such an excellent little shocker. I want our listeners to see it and enjoy all of the camera perspectives and the way he plays with them. But we have what we call a final girl. So one of the threatened women who survive and is smart and has agency and has a personality. So I think the whole misogyny argument sort of goes out the window with that, right? It's a horror movie, people. Anyway, so while it's not his best film, I think, in his entire oeuvre, I think it's one of my favorites because it's so very disciplined. Horror films, I think, in general, rely on an audience who basically know what is supposed to happen, right? Very sophisticated audience. You know that what Freddy Krueger is going to, you know, threaten someone or splash someone over the ceiling, or we know what should happen. And that's why this very disciplined approach of the amateur detective trying to unlock this mystery, which is partly in his own head, is very, very fun to watch because you know what's supposed to happen and then you get a twist. This is a lovely, lovely sort of, you know, easy to watch little horror thriller. It has a lot of pointless stuff in it as well. It has a chase scene that has no reason to be in there. But it's a chase scene. We love chase scenes, so why not? It's a big old operatic playground. So I enjoy it very much, and I've watched it a few times, I think.
Well, Alan, what do you think about Bird with the Crystal Plumage? And would you say there is anything to the accusation of too much violence, maybe also directed too much, too often against women also in his later films? We'll talk about that. What was your take on Bird with the Crystal Plumage?
I mean, I think it's not one of the first ones I watched. So although it's his debut, I think I came to it after having watched quite a few of his other films. And so at the start, you're thinking, oh yeah, this is what he does. This is Argento. And you sort of forget is that this is when he started doing it. You kind of need to flip the coin and that this is when he was discovering that this is what he wanted to do. So it's sort of really enjoyable on that score. I think there is something still in the fact that, and especially in that infamous scene, it is an uncomfortable watch. And I think that's quite deliberate. And I think that automatically makes you ask the question, why am I uncomfortable with it? Like, is it something actually questionable about the film, or is it questionable about my watching of the film? And I'll be honest, I mean, I'm not entirely sure I know the correct answer to that. And I'm not entirely sure I'd want to give Argento a completely free pass on that either. And it is interesting that having spent a lot of the 80s watching, you know, scuzzy horror films, those I can watch, they won't disturb me now. They just seem purely comic. They are farcical now. And the fact that, you know, a scene like that in this is still an uncomfortable watch on that level. You're like, why are we watching this? Why am I getting a thrill from watching this? Is, I think, part of, like, its real power. And, yeah, I'm still not entirely sure that that's necessarily a good power. But, I mean, that's maybe something for another time. But especially in this rewatch, it was interesting about how much the stuff that I think he's quite deliberately doing to make you uncomfortable still has that potential to do it. That he goes, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He goes, I know this is dodgy. I am going to show you this and you have to process this. And I think that's definitely going on.
Well, I'd make the point that it has to be uncomfortable because we're identifying with the victim. This is why I think it's not necessarily sadistic, because we are identifying with the victim. So we can have the viewpoint of the murderer, but still have victim identification. See Halloween, for instance, right? Does the same thing, but all through the movie. So I'd argue that it has to be that disturbing for it to be allowed in there. If it weren't disturbing, then I would be able to follow the charge of misogyny a bit more. But this is, you know, hands over your eyes, hard to watch, mm-hmm. even though if you have a good hard look at it, not so much really mm-hmm. happens. But I'd argue the fact that it is so uncomfortable is why it's allowed in there, right?
I think so too. I think it's impactful and it's clever by just the shift of perspectives that you both mentioned. I think not just going from one perspective, but then also shifting, which we'll see much more also in later films, where he just cleverly goes from the omniscient camera to the point of view camera and beyond. I think it's cleverly done and it's still impactful. And I think that just speaks to the power of his cinema. You know, we are still uncomfortable watching that. So it still makes a difference. And I remember one critic saying also that he finds that many horror films are good in your mind to think about, to imagine what that horror film will be like. And then when you see it, it's kind of not so exciting. And he said, from his point of view, with Argento is the opposite. Watching the films, it was even more powerful than if someone had just told him the story of the film. And we'll talk about story and plot in Argento later on. But I think it is still impactful because it's powerful cinema. It's very cleverly done in terms of techniques that are used, the perspectives that shift. And I think that's why we're still maybe not moved, but shocked and disgusted at times. And we don't quite know how to feel about it. And I think that's probably part of his appeal, his international appeal as well.
Yeah, and he makes us complicit. That's why it's so nasty. He makes us, the audience, complicit with the crime on screen. I think in Tenebrae, it's even more explicit, where you have this murder scene where, again, a beautiful woman is again attacked. But this attack is seen from the window by a bum, you know, a homeless person, who is a stand-in for us. We are watching this film and we can't look away, and we're in shock and horror, but we can't look away. So he makes us very, very complicit in the kind of violence that he portrays, which is a little bit too clever by half for me. But it's at least it's clear that that's what he's doing. It's not an indictment, but he makes us collude with him in these sort of very, I'm not going to say graphic, but very suggestive little horror scenes. Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think on that score, he is still having his cake and eating it. So he's having a sort of exploitation. He's saying, look, you're complicit. But these films were a success, or a lot of these films were a success, because they ticked the boxes of what the exploitation market needed.
Yes.
And that was, we want pretty women, and we want to have horrible things done to pretty women. And there is an audience of men who do like this. And he doesn't subvert the genre completely. He's playing in it, and he's exploring it. But he's still having his cake by going, end of the day, I'm going to show you a beautiful woman in a negligee, and it's not going to be pleasant. There's a lot of knife work here. And, you know, he's not taking a further step to really subvert it, I think. I think he's playing in that genre, but he's still in exploitation cinema. That, weirdly, just adds to the uncomfortable feeling, because there's not a bit of subversion that can almost make you feel, I'm okay to watch this now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's attacking this. I think the fact that you know that he's making this film that is going to be a success because it is doing this kind of thing, and we're still watching it. Are we still in this world of exploitation? And that, I think, is interesting. But again, I don't think it's necessarily all good on Argento's point. I think he gets away with it.
Mm-hmm. And it's a clever recipe for the success of that family endeavor. You know, his dad producing the film, his brother being producer. They found this clever mix of marketing it that way. Also, if you look at the posters, if you hear about the film, you watch the trailers. But then doing something much more clever with it, that I think made those movies so long lasting as well. And I think we wouldn't be watching them if it wasn't for, I think, one element that I like in particular with Argento, and it's almost in all of his movies. You described it, Julie, this seeing something, sometimes hearing something, perceiving it a certain way, and then throughout the film you have to reinterpret it. It has kind of this Sherlock Holmesy element to it, perceiving something that is different, going into the details, rewatching it, listening to it again, thinking about it again, the great flashbacks that we have throughout this film as well. So I think that's what makes it so appealing, including, of course, the revelations that come towards the end of this film and some others as well. But of course, there's also the aspect of, is it just rip-offs of other great directors? I was thinking when you described Tenebrae, Julie, I thought, well, that sounds pretty much like a cheap version of Rear Window. So we'll also have to talk about that. So whereas The Bird with the Crystal Plumage kind of is the blueprint for much of what Argento did later on, he did go on to do two more of these jolly films, the so-called Animal Trilogy altogether. Then he did a historical comedy with Adriano Celentano, which I haven't seen. And then he came to what is our second example, called Profondo Rosso, or Deep Red, in 1975. He went back to the giallo, but a giallo with much more than one twist. It was also a slight twist into a different direction. Some see it as the ultimate giallo, the ultimate Argento. And Alan, you brought Profondo Rosso to the table to discuss. And yeah, I just wanted to give you a few words to say about your relationship to the film and what you want to discuss about it.
This was one of the first ones I watched, so it being sort of the ultimate giallo sort of makes sense to me. And to some extent, I think in the UK, or especially when I was younger, it was giallo meant Argento. So there was a long period of time where, slightly misleadingly, I thought Suspiria was the ultimate giallo film because the names were synonymous. And it's only sort of later that you learn that it was this other genre that Argento sort of came into and worked in and made really good films in, and then moved on to do other stuff. So I didn't realize that it was like ticking the boxes of what is giallo cinema. But learning that giallo had its own formula, and you can see it in Deep Red, because if you want to know the plot of this, cut and paste a lot of The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, because he's redoing. It's almost like it's not quite a remake. There's enough, I think, new in it, but it's definitely replaying with a lot of similar ideas of someone witnessing a murder, of getting an amateur detective trying to solve the murder. And the more you look into it, if you watch both films, you just find even tiny similarities. I think he had fun putting bit part characters who are similar in these films to just replay certain ideas. And I think what really struck me, having seen the films and to some extent the way that they repeat plot lines, is that I think immediately it makes me think of Hitchcock. Because the way Hitchcock had his sort of formulas that he would repeat throughout his career. So, I mean, he made The Man Who Knows Too Much twice. He kept using a similar sort of formula in that way. And you suddenly realize that that's one of the connections he has with Hitchcock. If he has a good idea, he's not just going to use it once. He's going to do it whenever he thinks he can do something new with it. And this is what he's doing in this film. He's probably thinking, I can do that better. Now I've had more experience in making films. And so, you know, it does get me thinking about the links with Hitchcock. And I think he is Hitchcockian, gets used a lot in terms of directors. And normally it means a little bit they're quite good at a comedy thriller. That seems to be enough to warrant being called Hitchcockian. But I don't think that is enough. And one of the things I think Argento gets as a Hitchcockian that very few other people get is Hitchcock did play with the uncomfortable. He did push the envelope when he was making films. And I think we lose sight of that a little bit because society has moved on. So what was shocking when he was making films doesn't necessarily shock anymore. What he could present as completely macabre now seems, oh, we've seen this a dozen times since. But Hitchcock did have that quality of just like, I'm going to unsettle you, and I'm going to unsettle you by betraying a part of society you don't really want to admit exists. I'm going to show you something that you want to see, but you don't really want to admit you want to see. And Argento does that, and he takes that forward. So he's almost in a way, I think Hitchcock was really struggling to find how he could do that towards the end of his career. So I think by the very end, when he's trying to make Frenzy, I think he's struggling to get that tone right. And I think it's interesting that Argento, when I think Argento is Hitchcockian, he's getting that tone right. He's doing what I think Hitchcock would have loved to have done in the 70s. He's making these elegant set pieces that are also imbued with a spirit that you will find in scuzzy 80s video nasties. That's what he's doing. And that, I think, is what Hitchcock actually was doing for a lot of his career that's been a bit lost because he was so successful and he sold himself as such a gentleman. But I think Hitchcock had that in him, and Argento has that. And I just love that part of seeing him in that Hitchcock tradition, and also a little bit reclaiming Hitchcock for the scuzzy pervert cinema tradition.
And Hitchcock also loved torturing women. We tend to forget this because Hitchcock is now considered high culture, but he's just as bad. Mm. You know? And Frenzy is the case in point, which I still can't watch with modern eyes, not thinking, oh, no, 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 dude. No.
It's true. It's true. Even though, Alan, I'm torn about the Hitchcock question. I thought about this a lot because you suggested that discussion topic. And I thought, yeah, in a way, yeah, it is Hitchcockian. I thought of The Birds very often, about kind of the strong colors, the attack scenes, the women in distress attacked by a monstrous force from the outside that you couldn't quite define. So I thought that was maybe closest to what Suspiria is in a way, on a different level. Argento himself always hated the comparisons. Apparently he said, no, if there was one influence on me, it wasn't Hitchcock, it wasn't Mario Bava, it was actually Fritz Lang and expressionist German cinema, which again, of course, is a case in point because Hitchcock is massively influenced by German expressionism of the 1920s and 30s as well. So definitely there is that influence. And I think there are a lot of scenes and elements that speak to that in Bird with a Crystal Plumage. We even have Reggie Alder, the guy with the yellow jacket, you know, he's one of the villains in The Man Who Knew Too Much. So it seems to make sense, but I would almost say, like you said, with Frenzy, it was almost the other way around, because apparently Hitchcock was asked once, so which new directors he likes, which are influenced by him or might be influenced by him. And he apparently mentioned Dario Argento because he had really liked some of his films that he had seen, and he thinks this is a promising director. So it's almost by the time that he makes Frenzy, he wants to do something that Argento did with Bird with a Crystal Plumage and probably even some of the other Jolly. So it's a good question whether it's Hitchcockian or whether Hitchcock became Argentian towards the end of his career, because he could do all those things. He could be, you know, after the end of the Hays Code and the late 60s, you could show so much more. Hitchcock wrote a screenplay that he couldn't even make into a film because it was too graphic in the late 60s. And then he did Frenzy, which was kind of his response to that. So I'm torn.
Well, and also generally, I think if you're going to make a horror movie, any horror movie, I don't care what it is, Psycho is going to be the granddaddy. I don't think you can get away from Psycho being the absolute granddaddy of any horror cinema. So in that sense, isn't all horror like Hitchcockian between quotes?
But I think maybe he protests against it. But when you get to the end, especially in Bird, and they have a sort of psychologist who sort of explains the murder. And I'm sorry, he's not only watched Psycho, but that is a massive influence.
Copy-paste.
That basically, there is, like you said, there's a twist ending that we won't spoil. But then they have a psychologist come in to basically explain it. And yeah, it's... And I don't mean it to say, like, Argento, he was copying Hitchcockian means he's somehow lesser or he's a disciple of Hitchcock. I think the influence is really interesting to see. And I think the influence goes beyond a sort of visual style. It's a tone. It's a willingness to redo stuff. That, I think, to reuse plots, I think, is a sign of confidence in what you're doing, which I think Hitchcock had. And like I said, I think by the 70s, by you come to this era where it is so permissive, if you want to show a knife killing, you can actually show blood. You can show it going through flesh almost, which Hitchcock couldn't do in Psycho. When you get to that era, Hitchcock gets lost. Hitchcock loses his touch. And Argento being Hitchcockian also means that he took on what I think Hitchcock did really well, and he takes it into this new era that Hitchcock couldn't. And that, I think, is where that sort of comes from in my appreciation of. And in just as if in watching these films and sort of doing a deep dive in a number of sort of binge watch, you sort of see, I think, there's a lot of common elements in his films. There's a lot of stuff I think he just replays in his films for the fun of it. He references earlier films for the fun of it. And so you're sort of seeing distinct elements that are there. And then suddenly I'm thinking, well, that's a distinct element that I recognize from Hitchcock. So the moment he's playing this game of filling films with treats to watch, to look out for, you start seeing his influences. Maybe he didn't realize that's what he was doing, but I think you definitely do. And I start appreciating him for that.
Yeah, and he plusses it up. What I really love about Deep Red is that he actually has a murder in a bathroom. I mean, guys, sorry, but you can't deny now that you're looking to the granddaddy of all horror cinema. He has a murder in a bathroom, but then he plays this game of one-upmanship. It can't just be a murder in the bathroom. It has to be like super creepy with creepy dolls. Somebody gets horribly mutilated. I'm not going to, again, take away the creep factor of this by telling you what happens. Mangles this poor person in a way that Hitchcock never did. But he seems to even play this game of upping the ante on Hitchcock, or playing a game of one-upmanship. Like, dude, what you did, I can make it like more horrible than you could possibly imagine. And part of watching, and I think Deep Red is probably one of the best or favorite or all-time favorite gialli that people watch, is that it gives this, imbues this film with like some extra Easter eggs for the geeks, right? Some Easter eggs for the horror movie buffs, some Easter eggs for the people who sort of get it, who get that this is sort of the top operatic slicing and dicing, cutting people to ribbons type horror. And it has this also a sort of subversive compassion to it. And not just a compassion for the victims, but a compassion for people who fell off society, people who live in the fringes. And you also don't really, it's implied in Hitchcock, but you don't really get into it. In Deep Red, you do. You have this beautiful, like, most sympathetic trans character of the era, I think, in that film, which you don't see that often. And certainly Hitchcock wouldn't have been able to touch that at all. So there is a sort of mad giggle of one-upmanship, but there's also some compassion there, I think, and especially in Deep Red.
Mm-hmm. And I do agree with you that certainly there is both the reverence he pays to Hitchcock and to other directors. But then by Deep Red, I feel he's really making his own thing. He has established his own world. And putting these elements together with his first few films, for Deep Red to come out kind of as this ultimate film, I think there need to be some elements that are typically Argento. And I would definitely agree with you, Julie, in a way, to take something that was there before in other films, maybe an expectation that we have, and then he takes it to a whole new level. And I think if we talk of influences with Deep Red, I thought of another film that we just recently discussed, Blow Up by Antonioni. By casting David Hemmings even in the lead role. He was not even supposed to play this role, but he was cast late, apparently. And I think, you know, by saying Argento is mainly Hitchcockian, we seem to miss some other influences on his cinema. And I felt Antonioni is a strong one, also by taking crew members from Antonioni films, like the cameraman and the writers and the editors. He was just as much in debt to that. And I think he also wanted to create this world of the late 60s, again in Profondo Rosso, this musician and his crew, and then the murder that happens, and David Hemmings again looking at something very carefully, trying to remember exactly what it was, looking at the details. So I think that's a very strong reference to Antonioni as well. But I would still argue, no, it's become something in its own right. And I think Profondo Rosso is such a work of art, also visually and architecturally. I was stunned this time by the use of spaces, the use of certain buildings, of certain squares. Having been to Torino several times, I always go back to that square where the murder scene takes place, with these white statues and this fountain and this bar that they actually set up for the film. It doesn't exist, but it's also reminiscent of certain paintings.
Yeah.
And I think there's another clue. There's a lot of artwork in Argento, even in Bird with a Crystal Plumage, this key painting we see on the wall. And he always reflects on also art, pieces of art, architecture, sets these huge apartments up in later films just to set a murder scene in. But it's really, you know, with so much effort, he reconstructs these spaces and combines them with existing spaces. And I think that really spoke to me so much this time watching Deep Red. He really has created this world of elements that are Argento purely.
But also filmically, maybe it's just me, but there's a little scene where our protagonist in Deep Red is looking for his friend, and he finds him in a scuzzy apartment with his, well, boyfriend, girlfriend, France or she in this case. And she has this get-up, like almost like a Kay Francis film. It's a very sort of 30s glam, Deep Red lipstick, big curly hair, kimono type garb. That I'm like, that almost references in a way sort of 30s Kay Francis glam pictures in reverse, right? So he seems to have a little wink and a nudge at his cinematic predecessors as well, more in general. I think he's just a big movie geek.
And if I might just add to the 1930s aspect, something I wasn't aware of was also the reference to fascist cinema. Apparently Clara Calamai, the character who plays the mother, an important character that we see turning out later on, she was a big star of Mussolini's fascist cinema, the so-called white telephone movies. And you see a white telephone actually several times as a hint. I didn't know about that. But he also seems to somehow reflect on fascist violence. And, you know, there's the victim. His first victim is notably a Jewish parapsychologist. And this is also a subtext that plays that I wasn't aware of in Argento. It's not just violence of a random murder against women or against his victims for pure revenge. It also has this meta level of the political in Italy at the time that I didn't pick up on. And I think Suspiria has that too. Maybe we'll talk about that later.
It's very clear to me that in Deep Red, the LGBTQ plus character, so a gay character, he meets his end in like what I've at first view thought was a necessarily humiliating way. And then my mind clicked and I thought, I get it. This is just the system grinding him to pieces because he is what he is. This is an actual indictment to the state and society. So that is very definitely there, Sam. I agree with you completely.
And just in terms of the visual universe, that point you were sort of saying in terms of how he creates this visual universe, what I absolutely admire is by this point, he's so in control of it. So I think I sort of put the notes that it's almost Vincent Minnelli-like.
Yeah.
That he has this way with colour that is still atypical for horror. And part of me wishes it would come back because it works so brilliantly. And it is just incredible in this film that even something that is just meant to be a killing is shot in this almost heightened universe that reminds you of, or reminds me of, the sort of colours of a Vincent Minnelli film. I mean, it is that sort of enrapturing in a way that it just sort of lures you in with this sort of amazing use of color. And then of course you go, and now you're in here, this is what I want to show you. But yeah, that's that's sort of an incredible part of this film, because I think you can definitely see him in his earlier films, he's pushing towards this, he's got an interest in color, and then this is when he really gets a mastery of it.
And I would probably add music to that. I think we haven't talked about that element yet, that besides the visual impressions, I think the Argento films by Deep Red also become very unique by the use of progressive rock. He starts with Ennio Morricone in his first three films, and they're quite experimental as well. You know, there's the classic Morricone chanting as well, Eda del Orso going off as usual, and choirs. But then Ennio Morricone got to really experiment with weird sounds and moans even. I think that's what makes this rapey scene so unbearable almost, is also the Morricone moaning that goes on at the same time. But then he discovers Goblin, an Italian rock group, and apparently Deep Red is called Deep Red because he was originally aiming for Deep Purple for the soundtrack. Something I didn't know about.
That's
as well.
Incredible. No. I did not know that.
Now, what I did know, a little bit of trivia, is that it's supposed to be called the Sabretooth Tiger. So the Animal Trilogy is no longer a trilogy, but there were so many Argento ripoffs by that time using animal names that he was just pissed off and decided to go for a completely different name. Right?
I was just going to say, with the soundtrack, one thing that really interests me is, I think if you come to these films later, so if you come to these films after they've been ripped off a lot, there's a quality of almost childish singing in this soundtrack become the cliche, that's become, okay, it's not going to be scary. We have these children singing la 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 in a ridiculously spooky way. It almost sounds like a spoof when you go back to the source, that it's just like a nursery rhyme that's been put on to be disturbing. Is now being repeated so many times, you come back to it, it's just comic.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you almost have to sort of unlearn all the repeated use of it, the spoofs of it, and come back and go, this is actually disturbing. This is like quite an odd sound.
Nightmare on Elm Street, right? I mean, that has this...
Poltergeist.
Right? Mm. That has all these little children's tunes. Now, also, this is not new, because even Agatha Christie liked to use no nursery rhymes in creepy ways, right? But the Goblin score, that really is disturbing, people.
It truly is.
But it's the OTT quality of it. That it's children's... Like, in the opening scenes, you have this sort of horrible scene from a protagonist's point of view, with seemingly a child's point of view. And you have the sort of nursery, disturbing singing. And they've turned it up to 11 for this. Yeah. And that has been spoofed so much that to have it at 11 suddenly becomes, oh, that's ridiculous. It's not subtle. It's not. And sort of coming back to it, realize this would have been so in your face at the time. This would have been something to take it to this level. Again, like some of the graphic imagery, he's pushing it. And weirdly, this is probably something that hasn't aged so well because of the imitation, the spoofery of it. But I think you sort of have to take your head back and think, remember, this was when it was first heard. This is just a disturbing sound. This is just really unsettling.
But whereas the nursery rhyme element has been copied over and over again, I feel that the rock aspect of the soundtrack is still pretty unique. I don't see that or hear that very often in horror films. I'm not, you know, an ultimate horror buff, so I haven't seen like all of it, but I feel that's still typically Argento and very recognizably so. And I think by the time Suspiria comes along a couple of years later, that's really a key ingredient, is that rock aspect during the images that he produces. So I was wondering, should we move on to our example number three, Suspiria? So 2 years after Deep Red, something happens to Argento in a way. There's a little bit of continuation, but also he goes into now the ultimate supernatural as type of story. So gone is the giallo almost entirely. Arguably, there's some of it left. But his screen partner of Deep Red and him, they both co-write what becomes Suspiria. They go back to a 16th century text by Thomas de Quincey, Suspiria de Profundis, and they actually adapt it to a type of a fairy tale horror story set in South Germany, based on an anecdote by Dario Nicolodi's grandmother, who spent time in a school in Switzerland. Of course, that was of interest to me, where she experienced witchcraft, or actually at least people devoted to witchcraft. And she told Daria about that, and together they developed the story of Suspiria, a young ballet dancer who comes to southern Germany, goes to a ballet school, and then experiences like murders happening and some weird stuff altogether completely wrong with that school. That school is eerily lit and has eerie sounds all along, and the murders just keep on piling up. And she tries to figure out again, by what she's seen, what she's heard, what could be behind it. But the answer is very, very different from the giallo. And here, I think, with Suspiria, that was Argento's most famous and most successful film to date. almost entirely gone is the crime story. It seems to be kind of going on in the background, and it seems to be much more focused on this young ballet dancer played by Jessica Harper, famous from Hair. So she's kind of a musical star at the time when this comes out. I wanted to pick up on one element that we haven't really discussed directly, which is plot in Argento. And very, very often, even though people admire his films for their visual qualities, for the music, for the scenes, the staging, they say, well, but the stories just absolutely make no sense. They start somewhere and then by Suspiria, I mean, does he really care about what the story is? Is there really something like characterization and suspense outside of those single scenes? And I think Suspiria is a case in point, a movie that I never really remembered up to a certain point, and then I didn't know what happened in the rest of the film. And this time I really tried to focus on what is the actual storyline here, because the first 20 minutes are arguably fantastic and scary and spooky, and everyone remembers kind of the beginning of the film, maybe the ending. But what's there in between? So I wanted to ask you, looking at Argento, how important is plot? Is it just an excuse for stringing together all those scenes that are wonderful? Is it not important? So how did you read that, especially with regard to Suspiria?
Well, he doesn't seem to care, does he? He just goes like, this looks going to be great, guys. Come on, let's do all the colors. Let's go completely rock opera in a story about Little Red Riding Hood. He doesn't seem to care. I don't if he doesn't, right? I'm like, okay, fine. So it's just really pretty and eerie and creepy and the colors are gorgeous and ballet, fine. You know? It's like, I don't think he cares. He just thinks either the plot is a reason to string together a series of murders, right, with a serial killer plot that he keeps repeating, or it's just a reason to put people in a certain situation where things can get really eerie and creepy. And it's a really almost rock opera type thing in Suspiria. I mean, you start with Little Red Riding Hood and then you go completely psycho. Why not?
I mean, I think that this is sort of stretching the parallel with musicals, but I think it almost fits in that tradition that you have the set piece. You're here to see the set piece. You don't really need to justify it. The set piece will end. You have it in a musical, you'll have a musical number. It will end. The characters don't then go, hang on, what did we just do? Like, singing is that wasn't quite normal. How did everyone know what dance moves they needed to do in this street scene? It's just accepted as part of the universe. And I think he's working in this world where that is how it works now. And even as early as Birded with the Crystal Plumage, there's something that just triggered me thinking that that's a set piece for itself, like a musical. And it's weirdly, there's a scene where the lead gets attacked with a machete in the street.
Yeah.
And he survives. And an old lady goes, you okay? And he goes, yeah, I'm fine. And he carries on his plot. He carries on home. And there's no, someone tried to kill me with a machete in the street. I'm calling the police. I've got PTSD. It is literally, we've had a little sort of spooky set piece, ended it with a bit of a gag with an old lady sort of concerned about. And then he just goes right back to exactly where he was before it happened, which is heading to his girlfriend's place.
He even has a bit of fun with it because he tells him what happened on the day. Yeah. And she doesn't believe him. She's like, yeah, haha, you know.
It's so weird. And that's a sort of weird logic of thinking, I want this to happen. I want there to be this threat. I want to make people think, oh, machetes could be lurking around every corner. But I don't quite want my character to be the sort of realistic, how people would realistically behave if they've just been attacked by a stranger with a machete. I can't go down that route on the plot because he'll start doing very different things than amateur detective work.
You would never go and try and find the bloody murderer. No, you've just almost had your head chopped off. I mean,
it's all this interesting, the sort of, I want this in here and it works in here and it doesn't have to work within the strains of a plot narrative or how you would expect the characters to respond to it.
But don't you think you'd have to kind of switch, not switch off your brain, but to kind of switch your perception and tell the audience, you know, this is an Argento film, don't focus on the story. Because with certain Argento movies, I get terribly annoyed after a while because it doesn't work out so well. I felt some do that better than others, and I wonder what it is, because I feel in Deep Red, there is a type of a thread that pulls you along, and there's a mystery to be solved. And I think by Suspiria, this mystery to me is a little bit less interesting or less involving. I kind of get a little bit bored throughout the story, which with Deep Red, and I feel the Bird with the Crystal Plumage, I didn't. there was, I think, this element of, he tries to remember the gallery scene again. So where do we piece these, you know, puzzles together? There's enough to keep me interested with the painting that they analyze and the people he meets. And with Deep Red, I feel, he keeps going back to this apartment and then he keeps going back to this location and he tries to remember again. So there is that. It's more cleverly done. By Suspiria, I felt, and with the later Argento, I always felt it's really just grand guignol. It's just, you know, one grand set piece after another. And the in-between is bad. The dialogue is
terrible,
atrocious. The dubbing is so bad with many of them. They speak in all kinds of different languages and they get dubbed into Italian and into English for the international version. And some films even got edited so that stuff is missing. So they make even less sense. So didn't you get annoyed by some of that as well?
Well, not actively, but what I recognize is the retention. When I watch, for instance, Bird Again, or when I watch Tenebrae, tries to be a little bit of both. I'm not sure about Tenebrae. Or when I watch Profondo Rosso, I sort of still remember, oh yeah, this, oh yeah, that. And then there's a couple of details where I'm like, oh yeah, that was there. That's cool. But with Suspiria, every time I watch it, I'm watching it for the first time because I've remembered absolutely nothing except the opening, sort of when metaphorically the curtains open and she's on her way to this creepy school and she's all little Red Riding Hood in the forest and at this creepy school. And the rest of it sort of eludes me. And then I watch it again. I'm like, oh yeah, that was this really horrible murder with a girl getting, you know, squidgied up and her eyes popping out and stuff. Damn, I forgot that. So it's not actively annoying. It just doesn't stick with you.
And I think I always feel a little bit that I think one of the reasons Suspiria was so successful is that it must have felt quite new to be this plotless. That must have, again, unsettled the audience, suddenly realizing we even familiar ways through horror films aren't available to us now. We don't know who we're meant to be following. We don't have a story structure that we can hang on to. And I think that is inventive in Suspiria. And I think it works there. But what I also think is he never then goes further with it. He never really cuts the cord completely. He never makes a film that almost becomes abstract. He always kind of, underneath it all, there is a bit of a B-movie plot. And Suspiria is the same. I mean, you get to the end and it's like all the weird things happening. It was a witch. It's a house of witches, kill the witch. And it kind of explains it. It feels I've got to have a sort of explanation and a resolution. And I think it's a shame that I don't think he really can let go of that and make a horror film that is going to unsettle you and doesn't, you know, he will ignore plot, I think, for effect. And I think he feels less and less the need to fit this together within a narrative. But I think if he sees that as being clever, I wish he would actually take it a step further and try and do something new with it and try and say, okay, if we're not doing a plot, how can I make a film this way? How can I really do something groundbreaking? And it's always a little bit disappointing that they are hard to understand. But on one level, there is a story there. And then you start thinking, is he just bad at storytelling?
Yeah, it's very Wizard of Oz, isn't it? That by the end, you just pull away the curtain and there's nothing there except a sad little old man. And it does have a little bit of an undertone of that. I agree with you, Alan. It's that if you're not going to resolve it, grow some balls and don't resolve it.
Yeah.
But like, it's a complete mystery, guys. Bye-bye.
Even though I don't think he had the freedom to do so, I think there were still some, especially with Suspiria, there were some influences from the studio, from the production that told him he has to have some kind of an, you know, a resolution at the end. So I think with Suspiria specifically, the ending, there was an influence that wasn't quite under his control. But I'm wondering, because he seems to care less about plot and he becomes so cross-referential, self-referential at this point, you know, I mean, the witch is killed literally with the feather of the bird with the crystal plumage. At the end, I thought, wow, how meta can you get by now quoting your own films and by doing those gags? So, I mean, they're terrible fun if you're aware of them. But I still get annoyed with watching Suspiria, despite all the Wizard of Oz colors, you know, the explosion of all the wonderful things he does and the technicolor he uses. And it's beautiful. But yeah, that's why I think Deep Red still comes up on top for me, because it still has the mystery that I'm interested in. And I'm always waiting for that resolution because it's so perfect. The revelation of the murder is so good in Deep Red. And I think it's very good in Bird as well. And in Suspiria, it's kind of like you said, you know, the witch's house burns and she leaves and then that's it. Credits roll.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, I think we've discussed this before, Sam, I'm not sure we did it on audio, is that then this becomes noticeable when they make a remake. And you watch the remake, you're like, this makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And then you think, wait, but neither did the original, right?
Yeah, and Julie, we discussed this before. The remake is so bad. Also because it tries to do something else. It tries to do something political. We mentioned that Argento clearly has some undertones of fascist violence. The same happens in Suspiria as well. Even the source material is somehow related to Jewish culture. And clearly southern German location as well is kind of reminiscent of the beer hall that Hitler had his famous speeches in, is in the film even. But the remake tries to do something really bad. It tries to use this kind of the 70s setting, have some RAF terrorist hints in the beginning, but then does nothing to it.
No, it's so weird. It doesn't translate. It wouldn't translate anyway, unless you do a straight remake and put Tilda Swinton in. But then you update the anti-fascist or rather anti-totalitarian message and you put it into these terrorist cells that were anti-Nazi in principle. Then you hint at that, you don't go there. And I'm like, I'm confused. What are you even doing? I'll watch it Tilda Swinton all day. Okay. But then, you know, there's a point to be made that the original really is off the chart. It's very Wizard of Oz. It's Toto, we are not in Kansas anymore. It's really, really weird. It's beautiful, but it's weird.
Well, I wanted to read you a quote to lead over to maybe our final question. Have we covered everything Argento looking at these three movies, or is there something that we've missed? This is by French critic Jean-François Roger. There was a retrospective at the Cinémathèque Française in 1999, I think, and he said at the end of his article, thanks to unique way in which he mixes triviality and sophistication, depth and frivolity, glitz and authenticity, Dario Argento's decadent and impure cinema is the work of a painter of fin de siècle horror. There's a lot in there, and I think we've touched upon a lot of it. But if you think of that quote and Argento, what else is there to see, to enjoy that we haven't talked about yet? Maybe Alan go first.
I mean, I think we sort of covered Argento. I guess the one thing I would say is that I almost wish he influenced modern horror more. That quote, as summation of his work, I wish you could start picking a lot more horror films out and describe them in the same way. There is a decadence to it. There is an indulgence to it. There is a colour to it that I think horror often, modern horror in terms of trying to be overtly real, or even trying to deliberately have a message. And I think both work. Both can be a good use of horror. But that predominates. And I think I sort of miss the sort of horror that gets described in a quote like that. And I kind of wish more people were taking that from Argento's work and doing beautiful-looking horror films again.
Yeah. I sort of trip over the word impure. This is the sort of meaningless... It sounds beautiful and it's meaningless. What is impure? Horror is perhaps transgressive, but I'm not sure about the word impure. So I think it just means gross and wants to be posh about it or something. But I'm sorry to be a message movie, but I want to sort of get rid of the stigma that horror suffered under, that it's, you know, somehow below serious criticism, that's somehow below film theory, below academia, that it has to be either political or it's just trash. I think Argento is one of those filmmakers, and there are a couple of others, who proves that this is not the case, is that something can be trashy and art at the same time, and it can be funny and horrific at the same time, and it can be self-referential and kind of too easy by half at the same time, and we can enjoy it as opera and Grand Guignol and what it is. We don't have to stick up labels like it's pure, it's impure. I mean, our last James Bond film is perhaps nearer to horror than Bird with a Crystal Plumage is. Technically speaking, in terms of what you actually observe in terms of violence, Bird has, what, 4 violent scenes? Half of them you don't even see anything. So I think we need to get rid of the sticker of impureness and misogyny and that sort of thing. It really does the whole genre an injustice. And I think while Argento likes to wallow in the kitsch of it, we still do him an injustice by using words.
And he himself even turned this quote around by saying that he perceives his cinema actually to be pure cinema, because he thinks with all the means of that he uses, the means of art that he uses, the scenes he creates, the movies he creates, he says are purely cinematic in the original sense. You put those elements together and the effect is purely cinematic. I guess dialogue doesn't matter so much as the images. Story doesn't matter so much as the impression you get from the film. So he even said the opposite. And I would definitely agree with that.
And do you know who else would agree with that?
No.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh, yes.
I mean, yeah, I think he probably has seen more than he may have been letting on. But that seems a very Hitchcockian quote to me.
Absolutely. With his silent movies always, you know, saying that those were actually his purest. But to your point, Alan, also I would wish that Argento himself would have stuck more to that quotation here, because I feel the later movies I see from Argento, the worse they get. And I think by the time we reach the mid-80s, I've also seen Tenebrae and Phenomena and the Opera, all of which I like in parts. But then everything else is weak, is visually less stunning, is repetitive, is sloppy again in terms of writing and dialogue and so on. So I almost wish Argento had managed himself to come back to his early qualities, because this seems to be a great Argento for so many reasons. And then somewhere in the late 80s, that gets lost. And he made a lot of movies, tried to go back to Giallo even repeatedly, tried to go back to the witches several times with that trilogy of witches, and somehow didn't manage. So that's my wish for Argento. Go back, read Roger's quote, and do it again, Dario.
Yeah, will the new horror filmmakers please stand up?
Yeah, where are they? Where are the Argentos of today? But that might be a discussion for another day. So I think it's a good moment to end this lengthy discussion, but it was really interesting, guys. Thank you so much for doing this with me today. Our Summer of Directors has continued and will continue into a next episode. Not too sure what it's going to be. I think we're going to keep it a secret, a mystery, and keep it in the shrouds of darkness. And thank you so much, Julie. Thank you so much, Alan, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Cheers. Oh, it was an absolute blast to watch.
Glad to hear. And dear listeners, yes, go into Argento. Start with Bird or wherever and just enjoy. And as we said, switch on that Argento brain and you will really have a grand, genial kind of time. All right. Join us again next time when we have a damn fine cup of culture. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.